Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. This show is available on iTunes, and like all of the shows, podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. Well, friends, we got a busy, busy show today, this week. It's epic. So we're going to start with the big film that's opening this weekend, The Batman. I got to see the film on Monday. I missed the press screening. So Emily Wheeler, fellow critic and fellow IFJA member, we were the last two that saw it. And here's what we thought. Enjoy. Joining me on Film Sociology, I believe Emily and I were the last two critics, the last two members of the Indiana Film Journalists Association to see The Batman, which was on Monday. She is a contributor for Film Inquiry and an IFJA member and soccer enthusiast, Emily Wheeler. How you doing?
I am doing good. You are correct. We were basically the last ones, but at least we got to watch it together.
Yes, we did. And because a little inside baseball, everybody has their own spots whenever it's a press screening with just us critics. And usually I'm up front and you're usually in the back. But this was a crowded affair, correct?
Yeah, it was very full. As I expected, people are very excited to see The Batman. So the theater was very full and we ended up next to each other.
So, yeah, this was good. So, before we get into this, I have to ask you, Emily, what is your history with the Batman film franchise? Because I think that will reflect for, well, I think every critic, their review when it comes to this particular one.
Absolutely. I would consider myself I'm not a huge fan of Batman as a character. So if it makes a good movie, I will enjoy a good Batman movie. If there's not a very good Batman movie, I am going to be more apt to dislike it. You know, kind of based on how old I am, it should be probably no surprise to anyone that I kind of picked up and saw the late 80s, early 90s versions. You know, the Tim Burton's ones were really my introduction to the Batman character. And then I was watching the 90s cartoons. And I've basically watched every Batman movie since then. I've never delved into any of the comics, so I really do know Batman really only through his film iterations.
And if you don't mind me asking, how old were you when you first saw Tim Burton's first Batman film?
I'm going to say very, very young, because I honestly don't remember when I first saw it. I have vague memories of watching it at a very, very young age, so probably like 5, around there.
Okay. So you were that kid asking questions a couple rows behind us. So, okay, I'm in my 50s, so I remember the TV show when it was in reruns, and I was 19 when Burton's Batman film came on, which is probably a pretty good 19-year-old male knucklehead. So that kind of fit perfectly for my wheelhouse. And then, you know, as time goes on, I wound up seeing all of them. And by the way, friends, don't buy into the Joel Schumacher revisionist history. Sorry, they're not that good. Just saying, but that's just me.
Well, I mean, again, I saw those when I was very, very young, so I don't quite get that. I was fine with them.
Okay, well, you were fine with them to begin with, so that's okay. All right. So with this, okay, I have to ask. We will get to this, but did I see? Were you almost getting film-splained because of Matt Reeves's previous films, like the Planet of the Apes films and Cloverfield?
Exactly. I mean, I know of Matt Reeves. He's a name that I always recognize when people bring up. He's just, none of his films have made enough of an impression on me to remember that those are the films he did, and that's why I know his name.
Okay.
So sometimes I need to be reminded, like, okay, this is what he did. Okay, yes, this is my general, like, this is generally how I feel about the kind of films that he makes.
Okay, very good. So with that in mind, Emily, I guess let's start with what we liked about The Batman. I will let you go first.
Oh, you're putting the pressure on me to find something that I liked about this movie. So that gives something away about where this conversation might be headed with me. Because what I liked about this movie is pretty short. I mean, I'll say this. I think what they were attempting was really a really good idea. I think what they were attempting to do was do a neo-noir Batman.
Mm-hmm.
And from everything I know about, you know, particularly as you've kind of gone over the Batmans that I'm really familiar with, they tend to be the more serious kinds of Batmans. And that iteration of Batman, I think, fit perfectly into a noir movie. So I think, like, all of the building, like, the core building blocks of this movie and what it was trying to do is actually really solid and could have made for a very good movie and could have made for a very interesting take on this character.
Okay. Yeah, and I'm with you on that. As I was going through the notes, I said, because there was, I think Matt Reeves owes a lot to David Fincher. First off, he puts more rein in a film than Fincher does. And the procedural aspect, which has been done in films like Seven and Zodiac, you know, that's more, it's like you said, it's almost, it is more of a noir than the others. But yeah, so the other part for me that I kind of dug on it was, first off, we didn't get to see Bruce Wayne's parents killed again. Please give those, let those parents rest.
They let the parents rest, but they make sure you know about it by just having Batman awkwardly stare at another orphan child a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot of staring in this. I think Pattinson does a little less staring in this than he does in Twilight, but this one has a little safer purpose, I think. So, but there was the moment when we saw the alley. I saw the alley in the film of Joker, and I thought, oh, come on, really? Again? Come, let them rest.
It's very important to understand the Batman character to have that in. So just in case no one has ever heard of Batman before, I guess you have to include that since that is like the core element of who he is.
And how, I guess, we should put a poll out on how many that is. And I know this is for Warner Brothers and DC, this is their Spider-Man. This is, you know, they have to hold on to the rights, so they have to do it every few years. I understand that. I'm a big James Bond fan, but that's 20 some odd films in a span of 50 years as opposed to 10. So yeah, I'm glad they didn't do that. There is probably the thing I liked most about this film was the fact that you had a collaborative effort between Batman and Commissioner Gordon. I say soon to be Commissioner Gordon, played by Jeffrey Wright, who I really, really liked. You noticed the low-key performances in this film, especially from Wright as well as John Turturro and Andy Serkis. Even Colin Farrell sounded like lower key Jared Leto from House of Gucci, if you really think about it.
Yeah, I mean, to fit in kind of with the noir feel, like, very few of these characters are going very big, or a lot of people in past Batman movies have gone very big with some of these characters, especially the villains. Like, really only Paul Dano is going very big, I would say. I mean, even Robert Pattinson is playing his Batman very interiorly, and he, everyone is giving good and interesting performances, and I think are doing what they are asked to do.
Mm-hmm. And we were talking at the end of the screening with a couple of reps, and this was, I think, for Pattinson, and I know K-Stu has kind of been going through the motions of explaining not literally having to explain to folks, hey, I've done more films, and she's got a nomination for it. Looking at the films that Pattinson has done since Twilight, none of the cougars of the suburbs have seen those films, but they might see this one and notice that he did go to the gym a little bit. But there's no glitter, there's no gloss. It is a lot of him, you know, with unkempt hair and brooding.
Right. I mean, boy, I mean, that the bat suit that they have him in this time is really doing a lot of work on filling him out and making him look like a convincing Batman for what they're asking him to do physically.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, as you were kind of saying, I think a lot of people going into this movie really will think of this, oh, this is Robert Pattinson's Batman movie, because that's who everyone knows, and that's who people are kind of going to show up to see. After a period of him doing a lot smaller movies and a lot of movies that maybe people weren't running out to the theater to see. I think everyone is going to, or a lot of people are going to end up seeing The Batman and are going to be very curious about, you know, what he's doing and what he's up to in his career and how his performances are going after not seeing him for several years. And I do think those people will be impressed.
Yeah, and it's he's also a younger Bruce Wayne compared to the others. I think that's something folks have to take into consideration is, so I don't know what the timeline is, but he's, you know, because he's younger than the previous actors who have played it, he's still, you know, this Bruce Wayne is still kind of going through some of the sting of the loss of his family and the creation of his night job.
Funny where this movie starts him out, because the film really opens with him doing like this very serious voiceover and kind of giving you this idea of how he views himself in the city of Gotham. I guess that's where this character really starts out. It's just it's a much smaller idea of Batman than I think I'm used to seeing on film, because the way he talks about himself in that is like really building himself up as thinking of himself as like this huge presence in Gotham that criminals fear, but then like the criminals they show him like going after potentially is like a guy doing a hold up in a convenience shop and like just like all these very like low-key criminals. And I was like, so is he just like, you know, concerned about the guppies in the big criminal pool of Gotham? And it just kind of starts him out in an odd place. And I was like, I didn't know if this movie was like intentionally starting him out here in order to build him up to that.
I mentioned one character earlier who is going to who will have a bigger presence in the next film, because there will be another chapter, there will be another shot at this. So, you know, we'll hopefully see some growth as far as Bruce Wayne as well as Batman in this. There was a moment that, again, going back to Spider-Man, my favorite single moment in the film, and it made me laugh really out loud, not LOL. There's a flying sequence, and he just literally crashes and burns. He's not quite used to his gear yet, and that just said everything for me about where this Batman is at this particular time.
Yeah, and I mean, even in terms of, as we've kind of been talking, like where his presence is as Batman in the city, you kind of also started talking about like where he is as Bruce Wayne or as his regular person. And it's very clear in this movie that like he has no definition of who Bruce Wayne is as a person. He is really just like let that idea of him as a regular person entirely go and has never really developed. So like there's a lot of like the emotional aspects of how he is dealing with his family situation, and even they start hinting at a little bit like where his financial and the business situation of his family's estate is, and he is just totally disconnected from it.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything you'd like to add in the good pile?
No, I don't really have anything to add to the good pile.
Okay, so I'm gonna this is gonna be an easy softball. I'm gonna let you start with what's wrong with this film, and I will say, are you a charter member of the Zoe Kravitz fan club?
I'll start out with Zoe Kravitz. I would say I think that's a shorter answer. I think Zoe Kravitz, I'm like, she's the kind of person that she seems to pop up in things that I watch, and she always is someone that seems interesting and I would like to see more of, but then she rarely gets the chance to really do a lot of like leading roles and really be center stage. Like I know she had a series a while back that I unfortunately have not had a chance to see. So I mean, she's really always struck me as someone I want to see more of before I really have a firm take on her at all. And I do think in this movie, again, she is again stuck playing a side character. She is definitely not the main character here as Selina Kyle, and again, sort of in a role where that character is building towards becoming the more well-known version of Catwoman. And I think she kind of, with what she is given to do, I think she does well. I don't think any of the issues of this movie are on the actors
at
all.
No.
I think the issues of this movie comes from the execution of its idea. I said, like, the one thing I would say for this movie positively is that it starts with a really good core idea. And I think Matt Reeves, the director, just kind of overplayed his hand. I can't say for certain why, but just he wanted, it seems like he wanted to very clearly have this be a neo-noir film. And then he just, like, took all of the elements that you need to communicate that to the audience and then just, like, turned them up to 11 until they were just kind of thuddingly deafening for 3 straight hours and there wasn't any variation in tone.
Yeah, and you were mentioning earlier there also the development of Selena and Catwoman. There's a moment, and you'll see it in the film, Friends, where she's got the Catwoman outfit and what looks like almost like a wool mask. It reminded me of the cutout mask from the Fantastic Mr. Fox film. You know, where she's also just kind of learning it, but she has a backstory that we get. And without giving away a whole lot, I hope Zoe Kravitz gets to do her own revenge film. You know, let her be in a remake of a Pam Grier film or something where she's able to actually execute her goal for her character, because that doesn't happen here. And there was a moment I think you and I were both kind of chuckling at, not in a good way, of it was, let me do this. No, I'm going to do it. Okay.
Yeah, and that kind of brings up kind of the core really irritating problem that I had with this movie, where I really turned against it. Like, it's one thing for a movie to, like, kind of stumble what it's trying to do and maybe not be the most engaging film. But where I really, like, turned on this film and began, like, really turning into outright hating it is in the way that it started treating its female characters.
Mm-hmm.
Because it does have a certain amount of promise. It does, as you were saying, give Selena Kyle a backstory, and it gives her a clear motivation for what she wants to do. That is independent of Batman. She has this whole thing, her own mystery that she wants to solve of the murder of this woman. No one wants to help her with that. And that's where the film really starts leaning into very strongly into the male gaze. And I think that becomes a loaded term because people think that once you start saying that something has a male gaze, that it means that it's bad. And that doesn't mean that it's bad. It's just meaning it kind of is about men and it's going to emphasize their point of view. And if that works within the framework of that story, great. That can still be a great film and it can be films that I personally really engage with and enjoy. The problem is this movie, the way it utilizes male gaze and the way it not only overtly sexualized many of the women in ways that bordered on creepy, but that it constantly got in the way of all of its female characters actually doing what they want to do and accomplishing what they want to accomplish, and in many cases, taking it away so that Batman can get the credit just rubbed me the wrong way.
Yep. 50-something straight white male is just going to be over here going, yep, I'll be over here. So, yeah, that was rough. That was rough. As going through my notes, and I know as a critic, we get made fun of for pointing out stuff that maybe the average audience doesn't notice or in certain degrees doesn't even care. But there's a few times in this film where the filmmaker and the movie just wanted to show something that was cool and tense building, as opposed to, wait, hold on. And I'm going to give two examples that really, really bothered me. One, apparently Bruce Wayne's staff don't know how to pick up a phone. And when you see this, and you'll know what I mean, because there's a major plot point involving a character and a phone that doesn't get picked up. It is reminiscent, if you remember Spider-Man 3, why does James Franco's butler suddenly turn into Remains of the Day and wait until the third film to reveal a major plot point to his employer? Got a problem with that. The other one is there's a moment involving water and people and electricity. Kind of like you folks who forgot the body count in Man of Steel. This happens near the end of the film, and it's also really, really bothersome, but we're not supposed to think about it. We're supposed to focus on, you know, Batman beating up bad guys, who, by the way, it looks and feels a lot like a combination of The Purge and January 6th, and I'm usually not a too-soon guy, but it's an unpleasant feeling.
It really is. I mean, that I think, I would hope that everyone is kind of a little uneasy about those aspects of the film, and I'm sure these were written and conceived before all of these things happened. It's just kind of poor timing would be my guess.
Yeah. I mean, this but is like I Army mean, Hammer bad timing.
Yeah. This is really bad timing. But I mean, even putting that aside of just the bad timing, like, as you were saying, like, what happens there, like, is structurally bad writing, because ultimately Batman fails, but you're supposed to play it as a triumph. And I was like, I think he failed a little too hard for me to go with him having a heroic ending here.
Yeah, when you're saying we will rebuild, which sounds like it's more New Orleans than Gotham / New York. Not cool. Not cool. Also,
and the fact that, like, to be specific, that, like, that line and that whole thing that they try to apply to Batman is exactly what the female mayor was wanting to do. And it's like, why are you taking that from her? Like, she's still here. Like, she can do that.
I believe she just got elected as well. So,
yeah, like, I think she, like, literally was just about to achieve that. But then you're like, no, Batman's going to do it. It's like, wait a second.
We laugh because it hurts, friends. Yeah, the film overall has I'm going through my notes because I want to make sure I get these in. You know, the really, really, because it's rainy and dark and gray and it's so saturated, it makes Christopher Nolan's films look like Joel Schumacher's films. There's also, if it helps if you've not seen The Dark Knight, because you're going to get a confrontation between the main villain and its hero, which we saw back when Heath Ledger was alive. And Paul, as much as I like Paul Dano, I didn't realize that dude is 37, and I hope he enjoys the playing of younger characters as long as he can. Enjoy this. But it's kind of a JV version of the big confrontation between hero and villain.
Right. I mean, this movie kind of runs into a situation where, because there have been so many iterations of Batman, and because they just, like, keep, as you were saying earlier, trotting him out over and over and over again, it's kind of bordering on the point of overkill. So they're starting to rehash their own ideas about this character to the point where they are, as you were saying, rehashing actual scenarios that they've already played out between characters or between very similar characters.
Yep. Oh, and by the way, it's almost 3 hours long, and there's about as many endings as Lord of the Rings.
And it gets to 3 hours because the core of this film, being kind of a noir, is that there's this, like, mystery going on where they're going, I would say puzzle piece, but because we're dealing with the Riddler as the bad guy, we're going from riddle to riddle, and everyone's just really bad at solving the riddles, and that's what extends the runtime more than anything else. Like, there is one riddle that they read out, and me, as someone, as I've already said, like, not a Batman aficionado at all, it's like, I know exactly who this is, I know exactly how to solve this riddle, and they have to go find, like, another clue to figure it out, and I was like, this just added, like, 20 minutes to a three-hour-long film, and it makes no sense. Why would Batman not know the answer to that?
We have a deleted scene of Robert Pattinson and Andy Serkis, and he's just and Alfred is just drilling him with riddles and a yardstick and just slapping him on the wrist every time he doesn't answer immediately. I don't, you know, we'll see that when it comes out on video. We'll see.
Well, you want to say, like, you're saying that, like, you're the man standing back. Well, I think that's basically, like, how Batman has become in this movie, because if you see how Alfred treats him and helps him, he just does everything for him. Like, at one point, Batman asked him to help with, or I don't know if he even asked, or Alfred just starts doing it for him, and yeah, he just solves one for him. And I was like, you could let him, like, learn and do it himself. That might be good for him.
Yeah, certainly. And as watching it, because I've always liked the actors who have played Alfred, and I like Andy Serkis. It's nice to see him in physical form, and you know, there's a couple scenes where I'm like, okay, it's not a whole lot to work with, but he does get one hospital bed scene, not giving away too much, and he's got enough energy to exhaust a monologue out of his system, and maybe realize maybe he hasn't been the greatest parent, even though he's not supposed to be a parent. He's a staff. Is, you know, whatever. But yeah, there's it's not E.M. Forrester's the Batman as far as the relationship between staff and employee.
You'll have to take that one, because as a non-Batman aficionado, I don't know how that difference breaks down.
Oh, I just love mixing stuff like Howard Zinn and DC movies. Why not?
Oh, okay.
That's all. So,
no, but I'm missing a connection.
No, just old, you know, old movie quotes and references. That's what, you know, that's film sociology. So it's okay. Yeah. Not a problem. Gosh, are we missing anything else on this? Yeah. Is there anything else you want to jab at this movie?
I mean, I don't have any anything huge that we haven't already kind of covered. This is for a 3-hour long movie, this is not at all a complicated movie. And it's not at all a movie that's really trying to do a whole lot. It just tries to do the same thing over and over again. So yep. If you're really not into what it's trying to do, ooh, it's going to be a slog for you.
It is. Oh, and yeah, as we were leaving the theater, there was a kid crying. There was somebody who was about 5. As a parent, I would really, I don't know where to start on, you know, because every kid is wired different. But we had a kid behind us, about 2 or 3 rows behind us, asking questions every 20 minutes. And then there was another kid who was just worn out when it was all said and done. So just giving everybody a warning out there.
Yeah, it's definitely not for the younger Batman fans at all.
No, show them the Lego Batman movie. That's one of the best.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And that one, oh, and I for me, because I'm an old guy, big, dumb, loud car chase that made me laugh almost as much as the crash and burn, and the fact that we get to see the actual ramp of the car, of the truck thing. Jeez. I don't know how much it cost. I don't know if they actually did it. But, you know, there are 2 laughs in this, but for 3 hours, not quite worth it.
Yeah, I have to agree, sadly.
Yep. Well, Emily, what else have you been watching recently? Have you been catching up on the Oscar stuff, or are you just plowing through with other titles?
I recently caught back up with Licorice Pizza, so that rounded out all of our Best Picture winners, so I've now seen all of those. I don't know how you feel about that lineup, but I think that's a real mixed bag this year, even for the Oscars.
Well, I was saying, if going through my list and going through the nominations, Licorice Pizza was my number 4 film of the year, and so I guess if I had a ballot, it would be that one. I deemed it a love, kind of a puppy dog love story in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood clothing.
Right. I wouldn't disagree with that. I thought a lot about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood when I was watching it, and unfortunately, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood for me is a movie that didn't work for me.
So uh-oh.
Knock Licorice Pizza down there.
Yeah, there are no video stores, so you can't have the shelf that just says hang movies, because that's kind of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Licorice Pizza, Dazed and Confused, where you just plot happens, sort of. It just takes a while, and you just kind of hang out and chill. So that's what that was.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of great hangout movies, but I mean, you know, in terms of all of those big grouping of Best Picture winners, you know, Licorice Pizza was the last one I circled back to. I think Drive My Car ended up definitely being my favorite of all of those. I think anyone who knows the Oscars knows that, like, if somehow a 3-hour Japanese film manages to get into a Best Picture lineup, it's probably amazing. So that mm-hmm. should probably be an endorsement in and of itself.
And it's also, yes, it's 3 hours, but more riveting than what we just watched.
That is very true. I was much happier. It seemed to go much faster watching Drive My Car than the Batman, which honestly, that is surprising even given how much I like Drive My Car.
Yes, and how slow you drive in Drive My Car, and the fact that they don't have big, dumb, loud car chase, as my notes say, and scream.
Yeah, there's no ramp shown there that they go flying off of, unfortunately.
No, screaming Colin Farrell and no upside down camera. And the fact that it's about a production of a play, you know, there's some tension. There's more tension with the rehearsal process of a play than there is with Gotham turning into January 6th Purge Louisiana, New York City.
Yeah, and that's a pretty bad indictment of poor Batman, at least this iteration.
Jeez. Well, Emily, where can people read your stuff and find you on social media?
You can read my writing over at filminquiry.com, and I am on Twitter at MovieOp.
And working on anything currently for Inquiry?
Not anything big at the moment. I'll just have more reviews coming out of some of the upcoming movies, I believe, Turning Red and also After Yang.
Okay. Oh, I have a question, because you like you me, you are also a cat owner. How skittish is Selena's cat having to ride in a basket on that motorcycle?
You picked up on that too. Good. I picked up on that and was like, yeah, that was... I could not believe that happened. I was like, well, she's clearly not actually a cat person or has ever lived with a cat, because the cat will not be riding on a motorcycle. not only will you get hurt, but that cat will hurt your motorcycle somehow.
Yeah. So one of the stories with one of our cats, Dimitri. This was a couple of Thanksgivings ago. A friend of ours was going to visit their family for Thanksgiving. She got in the car and before starting the engine, heard the tiny meows under the hood. So she was able to open the hood, get the tiny kitten out, and then call us saying, hey, can you take care of this cat? I'm going home. I'm literally going home for Thanksgiving. And Dimitri wound up staying. But so we've had Dimitri for a couple of years, and he is permanently skittish. Just if you go, and he's cooled out a little bit, but there's that thing of just, you know, a sudden movement or a noise, he turns and runs. That and so that near the end of the film, and that we're really not spoiling anything, friends. But when you see her with a motorcycle and a cat, and like, wait, where's the basket? Where's the cage? Where's that? What are you doing? Oh, okay, all right, so. Cat continuity, friends. Remember that.
Yes, all the people that are showing up to a Batman film because we really want to see those cats with Catwoman will be very angry with you if you don't pay attention to those details. I guess I should say one of the good things that I liked about the Batman is that there are cats, and I do always enjoy when there is a cat on screen. And there are actually a couple decent cat jokes.
Yeah, there are. There's a couple laughs in there. Not enough, but... There you go. Well, Emily, I really appreciate your time, and I can't wait to see you in the theater again.
Thank you for having me.
That is fellow film critic Emily Wheeler. That's our thoughts on the Batman. You've been warned, so there you go. I want to raise a glass to some dead people we like, because we never have time for dead people we don't like. And I won't give you the timeline on when everything was put together for this week's show, but famed Tony Walton, famed set and costume designer, died this week at the age of 87. Was married to Julie Andrews at one point, but did a slew of Broadway productions, was nominated for his costume design of The Apple Tree, won a Tony for Best Scenic Design for Pippin, another Tony for House of Blue Leaves for Scenic Design in 1986, another Tony for Best Scene Design for Guys and Dolls in 1992. Just a slew of plays. And then received an Academy Award for his, won an Oscar for his art direction, set direction for All That Jazz, was nominated in that category for The Wiz, as well as costume design for The Wiz, as received a costume design nomination for Murder on the Orient Express in 1974, and his first nomination for costume design, color, was for Mary Poppins in 1964. Costume design films uncredited for Fahrenheit 451, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, Petula, The Seagull, we mentioned Murder on the Orient Express, Equus, hi Brian, hi Emma, The Wiz I mentioned, Just Tell Me What You Want, Death Trap, The Goodbye People, The Glass Menagerie, and finally the 2003 TV film version of Our Town. And as far as production design, we've mentioned, the title's already mentioned, Prince in the City as well, the 1985 TV film version of Death of a Salesman with Dustin Hoffman, Heartburn, Regarding Henry, and The Man Who Came to Dinner from TV film version from 2000. So salute to Tony Walton. And earlier this week, I got to talk to Greg Sorvig from Heartland Film about famed producer Alan Ladd Jr., who also passed away this week. Here's that conversation. Joining me on Film Sociology is the artistic director over at Heartland Film. He's got other titles, and he also has gregsorvig.com. We will get into that in a little bit. But I want to start with, first off, Greg, how you doing? Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. I think I saw you in person physically at the Batman, so it's good to interact with you in multiple ways.
I appreciate that, but I want to do the business stuff first and let folks know about the legacy of Alan Ladd Jr. We'll talk a little bit about his career and some of his films in a bit.
Definitely. Yeah, it's interesting. I think we have a neat connection here in Indianapolis because we actually gave Alan Ladd Jr., or Laddie, as he was affectionately called by his peers and people who he worked with, a Lifetime Achievement Award back in 2017. His daughter Amanda Ladd Jones made a film called Laddie, the man behind the movies, and we had that as our closing night film. It was just submitted through our submission process, and we saw it, and being a huge Star Wars nerd, and movie nerd. I mean, this guy is just phenomenal. And if you have not seen the film, you can see it on iTunes or other streaming services too. Again, it's called Laddie, the man behind the movies. But Alan Ladd Jr. was essentially a very humble, behind the scenes executive, who's an executive producer and producer, who really started in the early 70s. And he was responsible for initially pitching Star Wars to Fox. He knew George Lucas back from like the American Graffiti days in I think 73, and wanted to keep tabs on George Lucas. Laddie was really, really personality driven and followed people as opposed to chasing success. So he really nurtured talent. So not only did he greenlight Star Wars, but then he also kept Star Wars going when the Fox board of directors wanted to cut it in the middle of production with, you know, price issues and yada yada, and the rest is history. So really, if there's one thing he's known for, it's greenlighting and making sure Star Wars, the original 1977 release, was a thing. So someone mentioned we wouldn't have Galactic Star Cruiser now if it was not for, for Laddie.
Nice.
So he did that. But also, you know, he helped discover Ridley Scott. I believe in the documentary, he actually suggested that Ripley was a female character instead of a male character as well. So imagine Alien with a male Ripley. It would probably not be close to the same now. We'll never know. But, I mean, Sigourney Weaver is such an iconic character. And, you know, so really two science fiction giants were really launched by Laddie. And then he went on. He worked with MGM for a while, and then he worked in his own independent producing capacity. And so he's worked on, you know, everything from Oscar winners, Chariots of Fire, and Braveheart. He's also on Blade Runner as well as a producer, too. So, I mean, he kind of had the Midas touch on a lot of the projects that he had and just had an amazing legacy, a really, really beloved guy from everybody who's interacted or knew him.
He also comes from a famous show business family. Was this his initial goal growing up as far as getting out of his dad's shadow, the actor Alan Ladd?
Well, you know, I remember this, even reading about this in the documentary, is that obviously his dad was very busy, and he was essentially a latchkey kid. So instead of spending time at home alone, he would go to the movies back in, you know, when it was a full day with, you know, newsreels, cartoons. And really, so that he really began his love for film as a kid while his dad was still in the, you know, the industry and stuff too. And the neat thing too, even with kind of George Lucas, is that I think one of the first pictures I saw with Alan Ladd Sr., when he had his fedora on, and you can tell he was an inspiration for, you know, Indiana Jones years later too. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of people, if they grew up in the industry with their family, are either pushed away, but probably, you know, having the connections and the passion of, you know, being raised by someone in the movies and the movies themselves led him on his path.
Yep, and I'm going. I have his IMDb page, and when you are a producer and a behind the scenes character like Ladd Jr., you look through and like, oh my gosh, you look at all the titles you have seen or haven't seen. I know he started producing films in England in the early 70s, with films like Villain with Richard Burton, The Night Comers with Marlon Brando, and X, Y, and Z with Michael Caine, Susanna York, and Elizabeth Taylor. That's a bizarre love triangle, friends. If you've not seen that film, you mentioned taking a chance with. Actually, there is one thing, Greg. I wanted to, as I'm going through this, we all have ideas as far as the jobs that they have. Going on IMDb, he has dozens of films where it is listed as presenter. Can you give us a little more insight on what that means?
Yeah, I think that's more kind of the studio exec, where maybe he was with the studio as opposed to maybe being on the ground as a producer with the film itself too. So I think a lot of those later films was with kind of independent production company as well too. And I think even the latest one, when he was active, was even to Gone Baby Gone. And he was uncredited with that as well. But yeah, he had his hand on films in some capacity. Obviously, as he got older, you know, he was 84 now when he just passed this week, so he's been in the business a long time. But, yeah, still involved, I think, with making things happen on a high level, but not in kind of that EP or producer capacity.
Okay, yeah, because it's obviously a bunch of 20th Century Fox films. I see titles like The Omen and Silent Movie as it goes there. And yeah, you mentioned in 1979 he formed the Ladd Company, and as somebody who grew up in that era, you recognize the logo with the tree at the beginning of set.
Yes.
You know, you're like, oh yeah, that's that guy. And so there's something about that. It's interesting that I think for music lovers, you recognize record labels and their look. And I think that's the same with us, with obviously studios, and then eventually became production companies, that you started to recognize, oh, it's that film, or it's from that company.
Oh yeah, I remember that as a kid. I mean, just renting stuff, and I probably would know the logo or the opening animation more so than the actual name of the company. Like you said, the tree.
Yep.
I had a friend who up until high school thought the New Line Cinema film reels were ladders. She's like, oh yeah, the ladders. So, that's definitely a phenomenon.
And you mentioned one of the first noted films that he was involved with was Chariots of Fire. Was he an executive producer on that?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay, all right. And I know eventually he went to MGM United Artists in the mid-80s and then went to Paramount in 93, and that worked out pretty well for him because 2 years after he joined Paramount, Braveheart came out and won Best Picture.
Yeah, that's always a great feather in your cap when you're with a new company.
Going through, and the diversity of titles, and there's 18 credits as producer, according to IMDb. So you have an uncredited one for Police Academy, Death Warrant, the Brady Bunch movie, Braveheart, The Phantom, Man in the Iron Mask, An Unfinished Life. You mentioned Gone Baby Gone, and then something called North of Cheyenne, which has been announced, even though I got a feeling this happened in the last couple of days with his death.
Yeah.
So anyway, how was it getting him to the festival and getting the award presented to him?
Yeah, we were very excited to get him to the festival, and then his health started to decline back in 2017 even. So I think the neat thing is that Amanda Ladd-Jones, his daughter, who directed the film, came to town, and it was just one of my favorite festival moments. And she called Laddie up on the phone, and we put – you know, in the big presentation after closing night, everyone is just on cloud nine, a big celebration. And he gave a speech on his phone, which was played across the entire party and stuff too. And it was very, very passionate. You can tell he still had passion. He loved it too. Cause he did not get a lot of the attention. I think that's part of the reason that his daughter made this passion project for her dad too. So it was great. Yeah, I would have loved to have had him here in Indianapolis in person, but we really wanted to celebrate his legacy, and having his daughter here to represent him was phenomenal.
As I was doing research on Laddie, did he tell you to call him Laddie?
He did not, but I think pretty much any time you talk about him, that's just, you know,
okay,
the nickname from that point.
I realized, and I read, I can't remember who posted it, but somebody said when he was at Fox, he was also a guy who championed Robert Altman, and which sounds odd, but he, by the time he left United Artists, and he did 5 films with Fox, and these were not, if you look at the Robert Altman filmography, except for one of them, these aren't the strongest ones in his career. 3 Women I Know got some award recognition at Cannes and got really well received, even though not a lot of people saw it. But A Wedding, Quintet, A Perfect Couple, and Health. And, say what you will about Robert Altman, there's no test audiences marketing his films. They either crash or they soar, and it's all on him. And I've always been intrigued with those films and his experience at 20th Century Fox, but I know Alan Ladd was the supporter of Altman.
Yeah, I mean, it, especially if they weren't, you know, huge box office hits, you know, something like Star Wars, I think it's probably a miracle and a testament that many films got released in a row with the same studio.
Exactly.
So, I mean, again, so I think it's seeing the potential in people, even maybe when it wasn't quite realized yet or as instantly successful.
So we salute Alan Ladd Jr. Where can people find the documentary?
Yeah, I believe it's on all the major streamers, including iTunes, but Laddie, The Man Behind the Movies by Amanda Ladd-Jones.
So how are things happening over at Heartland there, Greg?
Good. We are already preparing for this year. This weekend, we're actually going to be down in Franklin for Best of Fest. So every year, It's funny, all these numbers and these anniversaries. It was our 30th anniversary at Heartland back in October. It's the 10th year that we've been at the Artcraft, and this year is the 100th birthday of the Artcraft as well. So if you've not been down to Franklin, just 20 minutes, quick jaunt down 65, you can check out this amazing old movie theater, over 600 seats. It started out as a vaudeville and silent film house back in November of 1922. And then since then, it was, it was like a lot of old theaters, it kind of goes under different management. There's many, trials and tribulations of not almost existing anymore. So I think a new person entity bought them in the 40s. And then I believe in the 90s, Franklin Heritage Foundation with Rob Schultz and Dave Windisch and the great team down there now helped restore it. So, I mean, it has a beautiful blade marquee that's been restored out front. There's really neat neon work inside as well in the lobby. Fresh Indiana popcorn inside as well, too. And it's just a great place to feel like, hey, you're part of something special. They play a lot of repertory content as well. But we go there and show primarily independent stuff, some of the top films from the festival. And we're going to be doing that this weekend, March 4th and 5th. We're going to show The Rescue the first night, which is the follow-up to Free Solo that won the Academy Award a few years ago,
mm-hmm.
about the Thai cave rescue. And then we're playing three additional films that won awards or scored high in audience voting on Saturday too. So we're gearing up for that. We have some more in-person screenings coming up that we have yet to announce. And then we're preparing for Indie Shorts or Oscar qualifying Shorts Festival in July. And then already the Heartland Film Festival in October. So a lot of stuff going on. I've seen a lot of movies, more so than usual this time of year.
Mm-hmm.
So I just keep watching all that stuff and trying to stay on top of, Oscar nominees now too. I think I'm down to one Best Picture nominee, and I've seen them all.
Cool. Yeah, I'm still kind of chipping away as well. All right, I gotta ask. GregSorvig.com. Please plug your website, please.
Oh yeah. Sorry, I'm here again. COVID realities. I'm here with my dog in the background. Excuse me if you hear her.
Yep.
But yeah, it's just kind of a neat thing. So I think, my website, for Heartland, everything there is at heartlandfilm.org. But yeah, gregsorvig.com is almost just kind of an online resume for stuff I've done. So in my capacity at Heartland, I'm an artistic director. So I help choose all the movies. I work with studios. So from the true independent films to the big special presentations and stuff too. I'm the main contact for all of that. Go to a bunch of different film festivals. And then beyond that, I'm also a senior associate programmer with Tribeca on their shorts team. I've been doing that for about 4 to 5 years now. And then a jury member as well as a grants panelist. I was just reading grants for the American Rescue Plan and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'll be going to DePaul University to judge their student premiere festival coming up in June. So really it's just, hey, this is all the stuff I have to offer, and letting people know I'm available for jury gigs, other opportunities, and that kind of stuff too.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's GregSorvig.com.
So you got to have some merch. You should really.
I'm gonna have merch. I'm not. Yeah, I'm not looking to.
Oh, come on.
You know what? Maybe I'll go ahead and I'll work and I'll. What do you want to see?
Oh, you know you should have coffee mugs and T-shirts, and your singer songwriter album. That you got to have that out there. Cameos. You got to tell people that they're a blockbuster and that they're an award winner. You know you want to do those.
Oh man, I should do a cameo. $1 per cameo. I'll tell you my claim to fame, which I don't have on GregSorvig.com. It's the 10th anniversary. I was a finalist on America's Funniest Home Videos 10 years ago in February.
Okay, what object did you get hit in the groin with?
Oh, I'll tell you, we lost to a plastic snake on a golf cart and a moldy potato chip. That old chestnut of losing on Funniest Home Videos, but no, but this is kind of funny. This is PG-13 for the kids listening at home. But,
which is great for this show,
Exactly. No, but we had they called it tablet trickery, where it was Christmas. I was giving iPads to my mom and dad,
mm-hmm.
and my sister and brother-in-law. So I'm just recording them. They open the iPad boxes. They squeal in excitement. Open it and realize it's not the iPad they expected. Giant maxi pads with large googly eyes on them.
Oh, God.
And, yeah, so then they, you know, they get mad. I think my sister is, like, ripping apart still looking for the real iPad. Hopefully, you know, in denial about it being a joke. Yeah, and then I submitted it via their app and was called in February, and they flew out my wife and I and two members of my family, and we got to go out to Manhattan Beach, California. And so I think you can go, if you go on Hulu, you can actually watch the episode. I don't remember, but it was in the Tom Bergeron era.
How many times did as a family practice doing the group wave to the camera?
Oh wow. I'm trying to remember. Like they positioned us. They wanted us in a certain order, and I think we did it. But you can still see this during the credits. I think Tom was rooting for us. He comes up to me, he looks me square in the eye, and gives me this very firm handshake, and he said, "That was funny." So I was like, "Okay, that's a winner in my book."
All right.
No, that was a great experience. But yeah, if you want to check that out, that's my other claim to fame. Not on GregSorvig.com.
Oh, that's great. No, I had no idea. That's kind of right up there with Emma and I being extras on Restaurant Impossible on Food Network.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. So, yeah. good behind-the-scenes stuff there. So,
yeah.
Well, yeah, we got to get that clip. We'll put that on there with all your, again, cameos by Greg Sorvig is, you know, I would break change for that, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You could join the pantheon of people on that. So, anyway, friends, go to GregSorvig.com and tell them the Blues House Party, and Film Sociology sent you. What the hell? Why not? So. Greg, thanks for being a good sport, and thanks for filling us in on Alan Ladd Jr. We raise a glass to his work.
Yep. Again, proud to give him the Lifetime Achievement Award, and yeah, like you said, we're all indebted to Alan Ladd Jr. and his legacy, so thank you so much.
You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Before we go around the horn and find out what's being shown in certain theaters, I want to tell you about not one, not two, but three films I got to watch, and the piles of movies that are in the screening room. You have to say that for another time. But sometimes you get into a mini festival. And there were two films from director Jules Dessin that I got from Criterion recently on Blu-ray, and then I was going over and I realized I had another one of his films on DVD, on the DVD pile. Yes, the DVD pile and the Blu-ray pile. But on Blu-ray from Criterion is his great 1947 prison drama Brute Force. This is the one with Burt Lancaster and a badass performance from Hume Cronin as the corrupt guard. Documentary filmmaking style, black and white, prison noir, one of Lancaster's early films. I remember seeing this years ago. This was probably after Shawshank, and, you know, if you like prison movies, you could. This is one of the best ones. But anyway, a really cool look at the class system inside, as well as trying to survive, especially when you put six to a cell, which happens in this film. And again, excellent performances from Hume Cronin and Burt Lancaster. Then there was The Naked City, which I had never seen before. I know there was a series, and to my buddy Tony, yes, there are 8 million stories in the big city, in The Naked City. This is one of them, and that's where that term comes from. And so it's a police procedure set in New York City, fronted by Barry Fitzgerald, of course, who won an Oscar for Going My Way. Probably know him best for The Quiet Man, but a very cool look at a murder investigation and a lot of the footwork and questions that have to be asked before we get to our culprit. It's another one. This was one of the first big films to be shot in New York City on location, because everything else had been kind of studioized. And there's some studio moments here. This film won two Academy Awards for cinematography, and rightly so, as well as editing. And it did get a nomination for Best Writing. So that was, anyway, that was a really cool double feature to check out. And then one I had never seen before called Thieves' Highway, which was the follow-up to The Naked City. This is from 1949, starring Richard Conte as a war veteran truck driver who comes home, finds out that his father has been ripped off and crippled. He loses his legs and goes to seek revenge on the one who did it to him, a corrupt businessman played by Lee J. Cobb. That's a go-to performance right there from Cobb. And this is one of the few starring roles I've seen from Conti. I need to work on my Richard Conti filmography. But another look at the trucking trade as well as the produce trade in the 40s. And some pretty good stunt work, especially there's a truck crash for 1949 that's pretty impressive. So, yeah, look for Thieves Highway as well as Brute Force as well as The Naked City. Just the films by Jules Dutton, probably best known for Rafifi, of course, Never on Sunday. But, those are worth checking out. All right, we go to IU Cinema Friday, March 4th, 7 o'clock, the SECS Shorts number 2, Holes and Holes, with an H and with a W, and that's at 7 o'clock, and then at 10 o'clock on Friday, the SECS Fest Midwest feature, One Last Time from 2020. On Tuesday, the 22nd at 7 p.m. is a virtual event, the 2018 documentary The Cleaners, National Evening of Science on Screen program, a post-film discussion, delete, ignore, delete, what happens when Silicon Valley cleans the internet. This will follow the screening. Thursday, March 24th at 7 p.m. from 1954, Magnificent Obsession. Friday, March 25th at 7 p.m., programmed by IU Cinema podcast producer and co-host and blog contributor David Carter from 2008, Speed Racer. That'll be something for your senses. On Tuesday, March 29th at 7 p.m., a post-film discussion. Well, first off, it's Close Encounters of the Third Kind. So we get to see the mountains of Muncie, Indiana, and Richard Dreyfuss in a Ball State shirt. Post-film discussion, Closer Than We Think, Social and Cultural Roots of UFO Conspiracy Theories, will follow this screening on Tuesday, March 29th. Wednesday, March 30th at 7 o'clock, A Scanner Darkly, followed by The Sound of Science, The Brain, and a composer Graham Reynolds is scheduled to be present. That's Wednesday, March 30th. And then mark your calendars, Saturday, April 2nd, 7 o'clock, the 2022 film, Double Exposure 2022 at world premiere. All that's happening over at IU Cinema. Over at the Can-Can, starting Friday, of course, is After Yang. On March 5th, Evan's favorite, Paddington 2. Coming March 10th, Charlatan, presented by the Heartland Builders. March 12th, Black in Africa, the Heritage Series, Whitewashed, and the FBI's War on Black America. March 18th, Reckless, Macy's pre-St. Patrick's Day comedy show. That's happening the 16th. March 20th, Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors with Vanity Rex. So all that's happening over at the Can-Can. Over at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin, Friday, 7:30 p.m., you still have time, as a part of the 10th Annual Heartland Best of the Fest at the Historic Art Craft Theater, The Rescue will be at 7:30 p.m. That was a special presentation documentary feature, winner of the 2021 Festival Documentary Audience Choice. And then Saturday, March 5th at 2:30 p.m. is a part of the Best of the Fest, Mission Joy, Finding Happiness in Troubled Times, for a documentary feature. 5 o'clock on March 5th, The Falconer, which is the winner for the best premiere and narrative feature. And then at 7:30 p.m. on March 5th, The Addict's Wake. That is, there will be a post-Q&A scheduled with that, with the filmmakers. This was the Audience Choice Indiana Spotlight Award. And then March 11th and 12th at 2 and 7:30 p.m., White Heat with James Cagney. And then Friday, March 18th, Pride and Prejudice at 7:30 p.m. March 19th at 7:30 p.m., that's Saturday night, Caddyshack, over at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin. All right, friends, let's grab a pencil. Let's find out what you've been watching recently. We start on Twitter with Linda, who writes, I Want You Back, Belfast, and Spencer. Jay Reed writes, saw this one on the big screen the other day, the 50th anniversary of The Godfather. Congratulations, man. I would love to see The Godfather on the big screen. Never have. So, of course, they're doing a lot of 50-year anniversaries of films from 1972. So if you get a chance, see that on the big screen. Okay, going to Facebook, we start with Greg, who writes, catching up on documentary feature nominations, Ascension, Attica, and Summer of Soul. That's my vote, Summer of Soul. Britt writes, Uncharted and Death on the Nile. Jenny writes, Coda, and deemed it excellent. David writes, Studio 666, Nightmare Alley, Wu-Tang, and American Saga Season 2, and the first two Harry Potter films. Thank you, David. Sam Watermeyer writes, The Batman, Batman Forever, Studio 666, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the newest one, and Dead End. Joe writes, A Fish Called Wanda, Free Guy, and Serial Mom. And Stephanie chimes in, A Fish Called Wanda always makes me laugh till I can't breathe. Fish Called Wanda and Midnight Run, two very special films to me. It's summer after I graduated high school in 1988. I think I saw both films like six times in the theater because I saw it with a group, saw it with a different group, and then if I've met somebody or came across somebody who had not seen the film, I would drag them to it. That's what happens when you have time between high school and college. Jay writes, Licorice Pizza. Steven writes, Joachim Trier's Reprise, surprisingly moving to me, flawed certainly, but definitely worth seeing. Going to have to seek out his other films, especially the current The Worst Person in the World. Yeah, you should, Steven. It's really good. Highly recommended. Patty writes, Cast a Dark Shadow from 1955, and Annie chimes in, that movie was fantastic. Jamie writes, Night at the Museum, Flight for the Smithsonian, Encanto, again, and Cruella. Doug writes, Love Me Tonight, No Way Out, Phantom of the Opera, the film version, film musical version, and a rewatch of two current Best Picture nominees, Nightmare Alley and The Power of the Dog. The nominated short, When We Were Bullies, and the new Peter Dinklage musical, how often can we say that, he asked, Cyrano. And I'm glad more people are checking out Cyrano. David writes, Casablanca, Greyhound, and Kingsman. Kevin writes, I Heart Huckabees. Thomas writes, Cyrano. Stephanie, different Stephanie, A Man Called Horse, deemed it an amazing movie. Lila writes, Power of the Dog. Nick Rogers, Nick writes, Asking for It, The Batman, Female Ninjas in Bed with the Enemy, Hudson Hawk, The Beast to Die, and The Adam Project. Jessica writes, The Princess Bride and Harry Potter, Deathly Hallows, Part 2. It was a good week for nostalgia. Understood, Jessica. Dustin writes, Pagliacci, am I saying that? Yeah, Sugar, The Town, and Encanto. Dustin, I'm glad you got to see Sugar. I really, as far as sports films, that is an underappreciated film about a baseball player from, a young baseball player, like teenager from South America, who winds up getting called into the minor leagues and then having to live in small farm town Iowa while trying to fulfill his dream of making it into the major leagues as well as supporting his family. Mario writes, 8.5. Nancy Ryan, this is great. No movies, but started watching Severance on Apple TV. Interesting. Definitely getting a Terry Gilliam vibe. Thank you, Nancy. Jed writes, I watched Mayor of Hell, 1933, with James Cagney, and Smart Money, 1931, with James Cagney and Edward G. Robinson. Enjoyed both of them. Also watched Singing in the Rain from 1952 for the first time and really enjoyed it. Way different than the Clockwork Orange version. Wow. Yeah, Jed, that the original version of Singing in the Rain, yeah, much different than Malcolm McDowell's version. And according to legend, and I believe Malcolm told the story, was he met Gene Kelly at a party, and when Gene Kelly found out who Malcolm was, he turned and walked away. Linda writes, Tom Clancy's Without Remorse and Deja Vu with Denzel Washington. Eric writes, all first-time views, because he does that. The Unforgivable and a Sidney Poitier double feature, Cry the Beloved Country and Edge of the City. Cry the Beloved Country from 1951. Chris writes, Cyrano. Daniel writes, My Cousin Rachel. Gretchen writes, One True Thing, which had great actors, but the movie not so great. And the 1974 Murder on the Orient Express. Don writes, Daddy and Them, after a decade-long search. Congratulations on your search there, Don. Roxanna writes, Patsy and Loretta. And I'll pour one for you, Rox. Miss you. John writes, Free Guy. We laughed a lot. Not groundbreaking, but fun. And The Maltese Falcon. Jamie writes, Free Guy. Britt writes, Encanto and The King's Man. Lou Harry writes, Finders Keepers, and in parentheses, yes, the one with Cliff Richard in the shadows. Lou, you don't realize Film Sociology is your source for Cliff Richard's cinema information, so nothing wrong with that. He also writes Better Late Than Never and The Grifters. Watch your oranges in that film. Abby writes, Prince of Persia, exonerated, The Killing of Malcolm X, exonerated, and 55 Years to Justice. And Screen Queens Rising, a documentary on the legacy of black women in Hollywood. Thank you, Abby. Keith writes, Swordfish. Hey, Hallie. Midway, the 2019 version. U.S. Seals, pretty bad, couldn't watch it all. Salt, Mulholland Falls, and Hannah. Julia writes, The Batman, The Worst Person in the World, and Hoosiers. Beverly writes, The Shining. Bob Bloom writes The Batman. Yeah, you should look up Bob Bloom's review of that film, as if this show wasn't enough. Michael writes Born Yesterday, Red River, Stagecoach to Denver, Wild, and The Drowning Pool. Eric writes a first-time viewing of Miller's Crossing and Fire. And yeah, I just got Miller's Crossing on Blu-ray from Criterion. So congrats on that, Eric. And yes, always look into your heart. Gary writes, Being the Ricardos, Blood on Satan's Claw, A Day of Judgment, Tales from the Crypt, Demon Knight, Prisoners of the Ghostland, Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings, Woodlands Dark and Days Bewitched, The Tender Bar, Threads, Beast in Space, Amazing Racer, Reanimator, The Mothers, Murder on the Emerald Sea, Captain Beefheart Under Review, Through the Fire, Dungeon of Harrow, and The Hang-Up. Busy week for you, Gary. Cassandra writes she saw Harriet, which was excellent, and Jeremiah Johnson, I have finally seen the movie where his meme comes from. Sometimes, friends, the internet is used for good. Aaron writes Free Guy. Allison writes Don't Look Up. Jay writes Death on the Nile, very good, and Licorice Pizza, and we finished the miniseries 1883. I know that stream, but it's brilliant. It happens, Jay. It's okay to watch a movie on a streaming service. It's okay. Joe Allen writes, Dial M for Murder, humoresque. The Postman Always Rings Twice. Which version? And then she writes, I must mention that IRT did a great production a couple of years ago, pre-COVID, of Dial M for Murder. Thank you, Joe Allen. Michelle writes, Buckaroo Banzai. Melissa writes, The Batman. Bruno writes The Darkest Hour. Cassie writes The Birdcage, A Madea Homecoming, Casablanca, Fame, and Belle du Jour. Oh, Belle du Jour. Kurt writes Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Robert writes A Hero, Free Guy, and The King's Man. Samuel writes... Okay, Samuel's got a post. Okay, this is how it starts. Okay, stay with me here. Moonfall. Oh my God, it's a ridiculous mess. Its premise is based on a conspiracy theory that's nearly as asinine as a flat earth, but somehow it kept my attention, mostly because I wanted to see how much more incredible in the literal sense it could get. That's what I enjoyed most out of it. I went to see a movie that would challenge my imagination's ability to stretch the limits of credibility, and in that I was not disappointed. It was stupid and ridiculous, and I had a great time. Samuel, I understand. And I'm glad you had that experience with Moonfall. Laurel writes Respect. Adrian writes Drive My Car. Taylor writes Red Notice, The King's Man, Caddyshack, El Dorado, Cast a Dark Shadow, and The FBI Story. Bonnie writes The Quiet Man and McClintock. Don't go over his knee there, Doctor. Jared writes Free Guy. Robert writes Atomic Blonde. Joe writes Vikings, Valhalla, and the 1961 West Side Story. Rachel writes Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox Story. I forgot how many cameos are in that movie. I forget how many music biopics they keep making after the release of Walk Hard, because it's cinematic comfort food, friends. Kurt writes Barbarossa with Willie Nelson and Gary Busey. That's an underrated Western, Kurt. Good call there. Carla writes, I saw Licorice Pizza. A few really good scenes strung together with excellent historical research and a really thin, overlong plot line. Do not recommend. Carla, I recommend it because of that. You'd call it a thin, overlong plot line. I call it a hangout film. So there you go. Stephanie writes, Cyrano, loved it. And Ladies in Lavender, loved it. Mary writes The Candidate. Jeff writes Coda and Being the Ricardos. Sean writes Night of the Hunter and Can't Buy Me Love. Sean, I know you. That might be a double feature. Rachel writes, Dangal, the excellence of which further reinforces the idea that any film with Amir Khan in it is high probability of being great. Thank you, Rachel. Catherine writes, Free Guy. Mickey writes, Cyrano. Megan writes, Cyrano, very artsy and at times a bit slow, but Dinklage, Bennett, and Harrison Jr. all delivered excellent performances. I was struck by Haley's voice, captivating and melodic. Dinklage was fabulous, as always. I had no idea I was seeing the actor that played Talos in Captain Marvel, proving Ben Mendelsohn is a master of disguise. Ben Mendelsohn is one of the great that guys working today, Megan. So I like Cyrano more than you did, but I'm glad you got to check that out. Helen writes, Fire at Sea. Deb writes, the card counter, and her response was, whoa, W-H-O-A. Stephen writes, Pig, and it was great. Leslie writes, Night of the Living Dead. Brian writes, Dallas Buyers Club and Labyrinth. And I know you, Brian, that's probably a double feature. Jenny, Madre Fool, writes, The Lost Daughter and Ready Player One. Can you guess which one was middle school movie night? It's okay, Jenny. At least it was a Spielberg film. Michael writes, Devil Doll. Terry writes, all New York City-centric films. The Immigrant, classic. Little Fugitive, great. News from Home, really like this on a couple different levels. Stations of the Elevated, King of New York, and Rhythm Thief. Amanda writes, Ombre, The Hustler, and Buck and the Preacher. And then out of nowhere, Linda writes, you people watch great movies. Well, thank you, Linda. We hope you watch great movies as well. Devin writes, Newsies, the Broadway musical, as well as the SpongeBob musical. Dee writes, My Fair Lady. And finally, John writes, G-Men, 1935. James Cagney is a federal agent is definitely a typecast twist. Well, John, you should check out Yankee Doodle Dandy. And the FBI story from 1959. This film was edited in part by J. Edgar Hoover himself to make sure the Bureau was shown in the proper light. Yeah, I know, John. And then with the kids, Madagascar, Playmobil the movie, and Mr. Popper's Penguins. And there you are, friends. That's what you've been watching this week. So hopefully you got to watch some good films that are new, at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. Friends, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. And this week we're going to end the show with a little audio tribute and a raise of the glass to actress Sally Kellerman, who passed away last week. She died after after I recorded last week's film show. That's why there's not a tribute on last week's show. And no, I'm not going to play her famous rant from the film MASH. And yes, I know MASH has not aged well. I realized that when I showed it to my daughter in her younger days. So, with a career going all the way back to 1957 in the exploitation film Reform Schoolgirl, back in 57. Scrolling and going through titles. Hands of a Stranger from 1962. A lot of television. Yes, she was in Star Trek. The Third Day from 1965. Boston Strangler from 1968, The April Fools in 1969, and of course, 1970, she received a Best Supporting Actress nomination for Major Margaret Hotlips O'Houlihan in Robert Altman's MASH. And then did Robert Altman's follow-up, Brewster McCloud, The Last of the Red Hot Lovers, A Reflection of Fear, Slither, Lost Horizon. That's a musical that needs to be revisited. Rafferty and the Gold Dust Twins, The Big Bus, Welcome to L.A., I also remember her as the voice of the seal in The Mouse and His Child. That was one of the bizarre 70s animated films. That's from 1977. A Little Romance plays Jodie Foster's mom, if I remember right, in Foxes back in 1980. Serial, Loving Couples, a lot of TV. Follow That Bird, Back to School, of course, for you teenagers of the 80s. That's Life, Three for the Road, You Can't Hurry Love, All's Fair, The Secret of the Ice Cave, played herself in Robert Altman's The Player, Doppelganger, Ready to Wear. Yeah, there's the famous moment in Ready to Wear. It's My Party, The Maze, The Lay of the Land. Did a 1998 film, TV episode of Columbo. I have to mention that. Boynton Beach Club, I Could Never Be Your Woman. She plays herself. Was the narrator in Delgo. Whew. Nightclub from 2011. Reach Me in 2014, A Place for Heroes in 2014 as well, the remake from 2016. So salute to Sally Kellerman. And with that in mind, a great excuse from the 1973 musical Lost Horizon, here's Sally Kellerman and Living Together. Here's to you, Sally.
Living together, growing together, just being together, that's how it starts, two loving hearts. Living together, growing together, just being together, that's how it starts, three loving hearts.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What kind of parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!